possible in the country.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. I love this place. And I'm happy to present something very different from the last several talks. Although people have talked about evolution here, and my main topic here is evolution and how we can study cancer by looking at evolutionary processes. There will be a novel twist in the story. So in this talk, we will look at cancer as a complex trait. I'll define what that is. And we will look at fitness valleys and look at how evolution crosses the fitness valleys. And then the new twist to the story is that we'll talk about a novel way of how things can evolve. And the novelty comes from cooperation. And there will be two messages to my story today. One is that cooperation can speed up evolution. And even more surprisingly, cheating speeds up evolution even more. Okay? So to start with, I'll talk about complex traits. Here's an example of a complex trait, which is a bacterial flagellum. It's something that helps the bacteria move. It's a complex trait because to evolve something like this, there are many steps. And presumably, a bacterium with a flagellum is fitter than the bacterium without one, because it can move. However, a bacterium with a part of a flagellum is not very fit, because it has to, you know, carry around this useless part of a flagellum, which doesn't help. So that presents an example of a fitness valley. So here we have a wild type, a bacterium without a flagella. Here is the bacterium with flagella, and its fitness is higher than this. And in between, there is a bacterium with parts of flagella. So this is evolutionary valley that evolution has to cross to go from here to here. Why am I talking about this? Because cancer can be viewed as a complex trait. There are many things that happen in a cell before it becomes cancerous. And so this could be, for instance, genetic mutations or epigenetic modification to the cell. And there is a whole chain of them that must happen before cancer acquires its final phenotype. And it's very possible that some of the intermediate steps can confirm selective disadvantage to the cancerous cells. Here is one example, which is a very common pattern in cancer. This is the loss of function mutation, so-called tumor suppressor genes. There are about 200 of them. And the way it works is the following. So here is a wild-type cell that has both copies of that gene activated, working fine, okay? And both of these genes, their function, in a very simplistic manner, is to protect cell against cancer. It doesn't let bad things to happen, okay? And then if one copy mutates, then the other one is still there, okay? And only if both of the copies are mutated, then a cell can acquire, a phenotype such that it starts growing, or, you know, some malignant transformation occurs. So there's this intermediate step. What can we say about this intermediate step? So it's not cancerous because there's still the second copy of the gene available, but it could be disadvantageous because each gene usually has many functions. So if this gene is mutated, then something may be wrong with the cell. Something else may be wrong with the cell. So the fitness of this cell can very well be less than the fitness of the original cell. So this simple pattern that is very common to many cancers may involve a step that is an intermediate step with a disadvantageous fitness. The fitness of the intermediate phenotype is less than the beginning and the end. So here you are. I put this in the context of my previous caricature. This is a wild-type cell. This is a cell where both mutations A and B happened. So we have two mutations, and its fitness is higher. And an individual mutation A or B actually brings in a fitness disadvantage. This evolutionary valley has to be crossed. So I spent some years thinking about problems where with such valleys, okay, And this is old work. I will only briefly touch on this, and then I'll move on to the more exciting new stuff. But I'll tell you a little bit about my old work and what else has happened in the field since then. So the mathematical problem is kind of, if we have this pathway, how long does it take for a mutant, the disadvantageous mutant to come up, okay, in different, under different circumstances? So in the simplest scenario, we have mass action, where all the cells, you know, kind of communicate with each other and are all in a large big pot. There is a spatial structure, and there is hierarchical structure with stem cells and the like. So I'll briefly touch on all of these. So mass action, it's a Moran process that some of you are familiar with. The way it goes is we have this box of cells. We kill one cell, and immediately another cell reproduces to take its space, like this. Okay, so the total population stays constant. And as a result of this, so, you know, every time a cell divides, there's a small chance that a mutation occurs, and we have to cross this value. Okay, we have to make two steps, and we are watching for the appearance of the double-hit mutant, the red cell. Okay, so according to one scenario, we can have an intermediate cell come up, and it dies out. It's disadvantageous, right? Or it comes up, it gets fixated, and then a mutant of a double hit mutant appears, and that invades the whole population. It gets fixated, as they say in evolutionary biology. Okay, that's called a two-step process. First, it becomes all blue, and then all red. And a much more likely scenario is like this: a few of those blue cells come up. They are disadvantageous, so they're not likely to invade, actually. But then, in the midst of those blue cells, a red one comes up, and that one is disadvantageous. It's very likely to invade. And that's what we termed stochastic tunneling. And you can calculate various rates, right? I won't go into details. How long does it take? So here's, you can go from one to the next to the next. That's a two-step process, or stochastic tunneling. And you can calculate the rates depending on various parameters. Now let's add space. Okay, so the previous model was not realistic. You kill a cell somewhere else, and it's replaced by an offspring of the cell far away. Now let's add a rigid spatial structure. This is a generalized Moran process, whereby you kill one cell, and a neighboring cell reproduces and takes its space, like this. Okay. So I actually solved this process in 1D, like this. Okay. But you can do it in 2D, in you know, numerically. You can calculate rates. And you can see that, is it easier or harder for a mutant to invade, for a double-hit mutant to appear and invade in this rigid spatial structure, okay? And if you calculate the rates, you see that it happens faster in space. And the third model that I'll briefly touch upon is the hierarchical model. Before, all the cells were the same, okay? No stem cells, no daughter cells, no proliferating cells. Now we assume that there is a stem cell, which gives rise to generations of amplifying cells, which have you know, a limited lifespan. And the model is like this: you kill all of these, the top layer, okay, and then these reproduce and replace them, and finally, the stem cell reproduces, and that's how this compartment gets replenished. This was inspired by the architecture of a colon crypt, or skin, or other epithelial tissues. So this is a simplified model of how these work, right? So now you also have the same type of processes, two-hit and a stochastic tunneling, calculate the rate, and that's slower. Okay, so if you summarize all these results, we have three different models. Mass action, the one I considered at the beginning, spatial model, and the hierarchical model with stem cells. And I'm plotting the rate at which a two-hit mutant appears. Okay, and you can see that the lowest rate corresponds to the hierarchical model with stem cells and daughter cells, which suggests hypothetically that the reason we have stem cells is to protect us from cancerous mutations. Okay, so if we didn't have this hierarchical organization of our tissues, it would be more likely for us to develop two-hit mutants. Okay. And the hierarchical architecture like this serves to protect organs from mutants. At least it reduces the likelihood of such mutants to invade. Okay, so I did that a few years ago, and other people work on this too. And so all the results were summarized in this excellent paper, which came up in 2009. And I'm showing this to you just to demonstrate how complex this area is. So these people only considered mass action, only two mutations and no hierarchical structure. The simplest model that I started with, okay? So so this is the fitness of cells. This is the original wild type cell. This is intermediate mutant, goes down, and then fitness is higher for the two-hit mutant. They did everything possible, investigated all the possible regimes and parameters, and they found six different, you know, scenarios. So the mathematics is very complex. And if you include space or hierarchical structure, this kind of work has not been done yet. There were results here and there, some of them by me, some by others, but this work hasn't been finished with regards to those more complicated models. But I'm going to leave this topic, and because this is a conventional view of how cancer develops, right? This is a traditional view of carcinogenesis. It involves accumulation of sequential mutations, two or more, they go one after the other. And as a result, sometime down the line, there'll be a mutant that invades because it has a higher fitness, it's more, you know, adapted to the environment. So it has been suggested recently that all the mutations don't have to meet in the same cell. Cells can actually engage in cooperation, in division of labor interaction. To motivate, I will quote another excellent paper, 2006, Axelrod, Evolution of Cooperation Among Tumor Cells. Okay, so this is a picture from that paper, and this is a conventional view of carcinogenesis where different colors correspond to different genotypes and phenotypes of the cells, and the blacker it is, the more mutations, you know, it accumulates. Here's an alternative view, okay? There are these cells, okay? You can see that they're different. These cells have bottom half black, these cells have top half black. It means that they have different mutations, they have complementary properties, and somehow they share them to each other's advantage, okay? So instead of combining both mutations in the same cell, there's a group of cells or a cloud of cells that can give each other whatever properties they derive from their corresponding mutations. And that's division of labor, okay? The existence of such interactions in cancer has been suggested in different contexts. For example, in this paper by Axelrod, they talk about growth factors that can be soluble and they can be shared among different populations of cells. Okay, so each cell, benefits from whatever it itself produces and also from what other cells produce. Other examples include angiogenesis. It's well known that, you know, some cells can adapt to recruit blood vessels, and of course that serves to the benefit of other cancer cells. So you can see that cells cooperate among each other in terms of recruiting blood supply, angiogenesis. Sharing of these growth signals. Also tissue invasion and metastasis have been quoted to, you know, exhibit such behavior. Interestingly, this picture has appeared today in one of the talks. So actually the name of this paper is a class action against the microenvironment. Do cancer cells cooperate in metastasis, right? So this author, even though as has been commented, it has not been proven that this is how it is, right? But it's been suggested that a certain degree of cooperation occurs among cells that engage in metastasis. And so that's another system. In other papers, like Sprovsky and Mali, that came out in 2010, they quoted four different systems, or more actually, modifications of the stroma cells, mesenchymal cells, breast cancer, prostate cancer, cervical cancer. All of these have, you know, exhibited certain features where we suspect that there's a certain degree of cooperation among cells that was going on. Okay, so that motivated us enough to study this phenomena more. Oh, some more. Okay, so this is a model. It may be a little different. So these are some sort of worms, and these are cancerous cells. And in this paper by Daisbrook and Kuzin, they looked at collective behaviors in cancer cell populations. And there is a certain analogy between cooperating insects and cancerous cells. Oh, and this is an interesting example. So this was a PNAS paper where they engineered two types of yeast. So in reality, in nature, it doesn't happen, but they made these two species of yeast such that they cannot live without each other. Okay, both of them produce something that the other one needs. So one of them cannot divide without the substance produced by the other one, and the other one dies without the substance produced by the other one. So there is a certain asymmetry of this cooperation, but they're both cooperating. They cannot live without each other. My student, I'll tell you about my model, but my student used this to parameterize the model and to show that, you know, she can reproduce some of the patterns of the behavior. And of course, they did this, they created this model with an idea that this actually exists in nature, okay? This mimics certain aspects of cancer. So now, what is the concept that was at the basis of our model? Division of labor, or a game called public goods. I was looking for a picture on the web to illustrate this, and I only found it on the Russian site, right? So division of labor, we all cooperate. It's clear what happens. So in sequential evolution, we have, so let's call lowercase letters the wild type genes, and capital letter the mutated genes. And let's suppose we have two sites that we're interested in, two types of mutations that can happen. In sequential evolution, first A mutates, then B mutates, or first B mutates, then A mutates. And the fitness of the wild type is R capital. The intermediate fitness is less than this, R minus, and the fitness of the mutant that combines both mutations is more than this. Okay, so this is the old model. Now add cooperation. If these two happen to be in a certain proximity of each other, okay, they can help each other, and together they comprise a phenotype that is advantageous. So without cooperation, their fitness was R minus. With cooperation, their fitness is R plus. And we have this additional factor. We assume that there is a certain penalty for cooperation, because if you share with others, it means that you produce too much. So you're penalized for giving away the product of your labor. And the more you cooperate, the more you give away. The more price you pay. And of course, cooperation can also occur between these two cells, for instance. So as long as somebody has B capital, everybody who needs it can benefit. Here's an example with five sites. Before that, I showed you only two sites, A and B. Here we have A, B, C, D, E. So if all these phenotypes occur within a certain within the neighborhood of each other, then the fitness of the participating cells will be higher, because somebody has A, somebody has B, somebody has C, D, and E, okay? Or it could be like this. This guy has A and B, this B, C, D. So as long as all of them are present, we have enhanced fitness. Now, we ran some simulations that, contain, it's a, what do you call it, individual-based model, you know, the agent-based model, where there are cells, they divide, they die, they mutate, we basically, first we look at the sequential evolution, the conventional view. First you acquire one mutation, then the next, and so on, no cooperation, and we run this, it takes forever. We wait until an M-hit mutant appears, a mutant that has all five, you know, different mutations. And that's how much time it takes. This is a histogram that tells you how much time it took, okay? And now we include cooperation. We assume that cooperation can exist. Look how much faster it happens. So actually what we record here is the time it takes to come up with an emergent property, so with a, to come up with a cloud of cells that collectively contain all of the mutations. They contribute those mutations to the common part, they benefit from it, and they have an increased fitness. And you can see that this is log 10, so this is a huge difference. So the evolution gets goes a lot faster in this case. And here's a typical time series. We plot the number of wild type cells with red. This is time, and the these are cooperators. So we start with everybody being wild type, and we wait until certain mutations happen. So at first, you see this is 10 to the 4. A few mutants linger around here and there, like there are 10 of them or 50, you know. But as soon as they kind of happen to be in the same neighborhood, they start cooperating. Their fitness rises, and they invade, and they completely displace the wild type. Okay, so that's what we show here. Now, if there's cooperation, you have to talk about cheating, because that's the next step. If I'm penalized for cooperating, maybe I can get away with using the public goods, like these guys, the free riders. I can benefit from the public goods, but they don't contribute anything. These cooperators contribute their labor, and, you know, they're free riders. Let's include a possibility of such a mechanism in our model and see what happens. So before we had a wild type and a cooperator, and actually we allow mutations both ways. Okay, you can go back and forth. Now there's a third possibility. You can become a cheater. We denote cheaters by star. Okay, so this is a mutated gene that corresponds to a cooperation, or it could be a cheater. And now this is the diagram with only two sides. Okay, so in order to get the enhanced fitness, you have to mutate only in two sides. If I had three or four, it's impossible to draw because it becomes really complicated. However, you can analyze it, but not possible to draw. So this is the old picture. AB goes through A capital to AB, or like this, right? That's the old picture. And now we have all these different types of M-hit mutants. This is a cooperating mutant. They contribute to the common pot. This one doesn't contribute A, even though it has it. This doesn't have B, and this doesn't contribute B. This is a fully mutated cheater, okay? He has all the mutations to himself. And look at their fitness. So this guy is honest, and his fitness is R plus minus 2F. He pays twice because he cooperates on both sides. This one, R plus minus F. He pays penalty only once because he cooperates only on one side. This guy doesn't pay any penalty. Okay, so this is the fittest phenotype. He combines all the mutations, and he doesn't pay any penalty because he doesn't want to share. So this is the model. Here's the old picture that I showed you. We have the M-hit mutants that emerge by sequential evolution. Takes a long time. This is the emergent phenotype. In the presence of cooperation, we have this cloud of distributed phenotypes. Somebody has A, somebody has B, somebody has C, and that's when it emerges. Actually, in this picture, you never observe the invasion of the M-hit mutant. These mutations don't occur in the same cell because the corresponding mutant doesn't have any advantage compared to the cooperating types. Okay, so we have an emergent property, but we don't have the M-hit mutant. Now turn on cheating, and here we have the emergence of M-hit mutants by cooperating and cheating. Look at this. This is how long it takes without cooperation and cheating, and this is a significant acceleration of the evolutionary process. And moreover, here we didn't have a single cell that would combine all the mutation within itself. Here we actually have the emergence of the fully blown M-hit mutant. Here's a time series. We start from everybody being the wild type, and then slowly cooperators come up by mutations. They linger around at low levels. They also give rise, this is the blue. Blue is cooperators. They give rise to the cheaters, this is purple, and they're also down there are not so many of them, until they kind of find each other. As soon as the cooperators found each other, their fitness rises. They go up in the cooperation, in the population. That's the blue line. But immediately, all these cheaters are like parasites that exist only because there are cooperators there. The cooperators are cooperating. They are producing all the substances. The cheaters benefit from that. They don't contribute anything, and they have a higher fitness. So this is like they maintain a certain level of cooperators as slaves, and they benefit from them. But then something interesting happens. It turns out that, cooperation is only possible if all of the mutations co-occur in a certain location, in a certain spatial location. It's a stochastic process. So once in a while, somebody who has mutation A can completely disappear from that location. So all the cooperators that need this mutation A immediately lose fitness. They go down. And of course, the cheaters also go down. And during that time, an M-hit mutant that could be there at low level in the population has an immediate advantage because he doesn't need anybody. He goes up and he invades the whole population. And that's how you get the emergence of M-hit mutants, which is facilitated by cooperation and cheating. So here is again the explanation. So let's suppose that this is a neighborhood where they can help each other. And we have three sites. So to have an enhanced fitness, you have to have both A capital, B capital, and C capital. And it's provided by these three honest cells. This provides A, this provides A and B, and this provides B and C. Okay. So these are cooperators. And there are cheaters. Okay. These are cheating cells. They don't provide much, but they can live because the cooperators provide those products. And now let's suppose that by stochastic extinction, this guy disappeared from the neighborhood locally. Okay? So nobody's producing C capital. What happens? All of these will disappear because they need C capital to be there, except for this guy. This cheater immediately has an advantage because he has all the mutations, and now while all the rest of the cheaters are suffering, they are lacking the substance, he can survive and win and invade. Okay? So that we have a domination of the M-hit cheater. The likelihood and timing of this process depend on the number of cooperators in the system. So I'll show you some more pictures, which is a spatial simulation. They're going to be, shots, the frames taken starting about this time. So at this time, what do we have? The wild type has already gone to small numbers. We have a large number of cheaters and a relatively small number of cooperators that cooperate and maintain the whole system. Okay, because of these cooperators, the system can function. They do all the work. So here, yellow is cheaters, and blue, dark blue, is the cooperators. The cooperators provide all the necessary nutrients or whatever factors that are needed. Yellow are the slave drivers. They are there and they can survive because of the blue ones. And we also have a spot here, the light blue, of cooperators and that somehow lost each other. In these local neighborhoods, there aren't enough mutations to sustain the growth. For instance, factor A is missing or factor B is missing. So, and you can see the yellow, the green, these are the M-hit cheaters that appear preferentially around these spots. And you'll see that they kind of spring from that spot and they start invading and eventually everything becomes green. So these are M-hit cheaters, the phenotype that combines all the mutations in one cell. Okay. So even though I told you I cannot draw a picture of the diagram of all the possible types, it turns out you can study this analytically if you assume mass action. And it turns out to be very, very helpful. The mass action calculation has a great predictive power here, despite the spatial nature of the simulation. So you can write down the equations for all the types, for all the mutations, and you can calculate the steady state analytically. And the most important part here mathematically for me was to calculate the number of cooperators. Okay, so this is the number of cooperators that you know, feed the whole system. If this number sometimes plunges, if the number of cooperators goes down, then everything crashes and the M-hit mutant arises. Okay, so this number shouldn't be too large, because if it's very big, if it's 1,000, for instance, then it'll never happen that it'll stochastically go down to zero. And it shouldn't be too small, because then you just have a stochastic extinction of all the cooperators. So you can calculate this number, and now I can predict, given the parameters, what is going to happen in the system and how long it'll take. So the question is, are there examples of cheating in cancer cells? I told you many examples of cooperation, but nobody has looked at cheating, right? Because this question has not been asked. But of course, if you're an evolutionary biologist, when you talk about cooperation, you have to think about cheating. So the only example that I know so far has been provided by Harsh Jain, who is here in the audience, and I haven't worked it out yet, but I'll explain to you the essence of this example. So it's about prostate cancer. So the normal prostate, as well as early stage prostate cancers, depend on androgens for growth and survival. And the way they treat this cancer is that they remove the source of androgen, and that causes the tumor to regress. So, but there are certain cancers that do not respond to this treatment. They are not cured by surgery. They eventually become androgen independent, rendering anti-androgen therapy ineffective. So how does that happen? To get around the hormonal therapy, cancer cells can do two things. The first thing is that they develop mutations that facilitate local biosynthesis of androgens. So even though you deprive them of those substances, they create it themselves and use it, right? So they are like local factories that replace the source of androgen. The second mutation is that they reduce the activation threshold for the androgen receptor. So these cells don't need so much of this androgen, and so they can live, survive on a smaller amount. So in the context of our model, these are cooperators, because they create this substance that can be taken up by other cells. Okay, so these are cooperators. And these are cheaters, because they don't create anything, but they can use stuff provided by these cells. So to conclude, what do we learn here? Sequential evolution accumulates mutations one by one, and it's a slow process, especially in the presence of fitness values. However, M-hit mutants do not come, cooperation, on the other hand, leads to a much faster generation of a complex phenotype as an emergent property. However, M-hit mutants do not come to dominate the population. Interesting things happen when you add cheating. This really accelerates evolution. In the presence of cheating, M-hit mutants are generated fast and come to dominate the population. So why is it generated fast? Because of the large abundance of cheaters. There is no stochastic tunneling there. There are a lot of cheaters that can create an M-hit mutant. And they dominate because they do not depend on the cooperators for survival. So this work is done in collaboration with Dominic Waters and also my graduate student, Arian Irwin. Thank you very much. Oh, that's an excellent example. Thank you. Maybe we can talk more about it. I take all the suggestions I can get.
Any other questions? Mutation and that they really collaborate.
Once this gene gets tumor suppressor mutated, the genome stability is not stable at all. So the cell interprets this that. After that, this cell, this single cell with tumor suppressor gets mutated. That high chance compared to other genomes, a lot of mutations can be appear. Okay, so it means that another gene can be mutated in this genome is much more heavy in tumor chance than another genome that are not tumor suppressor genes. So that basically has evidence. The explanation of that has been shown. And second question is,
can I answer your first question before I forgot, and then we move on to the second one. So this is a very interesting issue that you're raising. First, I'll address the genetic instability question. So there, of course, you know that there has been a lot of debate about when genetic instability comes, what the reasons are, is it causal, is it a consequence of cancer? So what you implied is that it's a consequence of the inactivation of the tumor suppressor gene, and other people suggested otherwise. But nonetheless, the argument still holds with or without genetic instability. So think about it this way. You either have to accumulate two mutations in the same cell. So first you hit one cell. It's a very small population because it's not advantageous. It lingers there, like there are 10 cells like this. And it has to hit exactly there. Or you mutate one cell, and another hit has to come anywhere in the proximity of that cell, which comprises, you know, a large area. For each cell, it could be an area of thousands of cells around it. So it's much more likely to accumulate two mutants in different cells than two mutants in the same cell, with or without genomic instability. So what you are saying is that as the mutations accumulate, the rate of mutations itself changes. And of course, it can be true, and of course it is true, but the increased rate of genetic change only makes this mechanism faster. So both sequential evolution and this new type of evolution happen faster, and this is faster yet. So it facilitates both sequential evolution and the evolution by cooperation. Yeah, so that's an excellent point. So you're saying that if it's an emergent property distributed among other different cells, then they cannot move together, right? Only one cell is going to go away and metastasize. I completely agree with you. However, my theory suggests that because of cooperation and cheating, eventually all the mutations do co-occur in the same cell. It's just this mechanism makes it a lot faster. So it, once this process is complete, you have all the mutations happening in the same cell. It's just some of the intermediate steps require the emergent phenotype. So in the end, all of them are in the same cell, and that cell can, you know, go. It can go anywhere. So maybe you can talk later about this. I have this whole theory that explains how this happens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there are six mutation rates in general. So there are three types of mutants, so there are three types of mutations and back mutations. They can all be different. Okay, so if you make some of them very small, that makes this theory much easier to prove. The most difficult case to show is when they're all about the same, okay? And it still works then. So I can show which configurations lead to a very ready result like this. But it's more difficult to prove when they're all the same. Yes, so most of the intermediate steps will be the same in the same sequence of events. There are a couple of different scenarios that come up, but the conclusions remain the same. Mm-hmm. This model is applicable to a hierarchical model. It should work in the same way, although I only did it in the simplest scenario where we have dividing cells, okay, and we don't specify what they are. So perhaps a very good next step would be to make it more realistic and include stem cells. I'm pretty sure the conclusions will hold because I understand each step, okay, and as long as cells are dividing, and they're in space, this should work, but it's a very good point. Good, thank you. I like like very much your first 2 points. And I can add that I do have a worked out example of when it happens, except it's not in cancer. It's in viruses. So there are different types of viruses that can kill the immune response. Some of them actually kill the immune cells such that other viruses can benefit from that. Others just kind of protect themselves, and those are cheaters. So we have a parameterized model. I just didn't bring it up here because it's not the topic. Yeah.